Thank you very much, Barbara. Hello, everybody. A very warm welcome on a very nasty evening. Nice of you to come out for this. I'm just curious, how many of you here are members of the Said Business School? Would you please turn to someone next to you who is not and welcome them to the Said Business School? Join me. Group hug. Part of the point of this is for the business school to reach out to the rest of the university and share some of its expertise, but also the great benefit to us of doing this is to learn more about what you all are doing in other parts of the university and the city of Oxford. It's very important, and I'm going to make the point theoretically in just a minute, that there be this kind of joined-up environment for entrepreneurship to flourish. The business school really only has one small part of an intricate process to contribute. So we're going to think about that in these lectures. But a lot of the rest of the impulse behind successful entrepreneurship comes from places entirely different other than business schools or management schools. And I hope to make that point over the course of this evening as I talk about how to evaluate a venture idea. Now, you'll notice I've not used the word business. I really don't want to imply that what I'm talking about are business skills. They are management skills, perhaps, certainly entrepreneurial skills. And that can be relevant in any kind of organization or in any kind of venturing situation where you're trying something new. You're pushing forward, you're experimenting, you're going. The skills set necessary for both making an idea a reality, but prior to that, evaluating whether it's likely to become a reality are what I'm going to talk about now. So if anyone in here is worried about not being able to understand sort of basic business principles like accounting and finance or whatever, I'm not going into that. Or if anyone in here is thinking that this is going to be an easy tick list of management decision-making frameworks and tools that will allow you to become Bill Gates tomorrow, I'm not going to go into that either. If I knew how to answer all those kinds of questions, I certainly wouldn't be here now. So let me begin with this sort of theoretical representation of this same point. This is an idea from a lot of different scholars who've put together the notion of the enabling environment for entrepreneurship. The idea being that there are a set of factors that, when coordinated, are more likely to favor entrepreneurial venturing. Okay, so this is a pretty simplistic way of thinking about how to evaluate whether or not an idea is kind of in the right context, in the right environment. And you'll note that we've got, for example, technology clusters right there at the top. So that explains things like Silicon Valley. Oops, this always happens to me. I always press the wrong button every time I possibly can. Okay. There. Can you see the red spot? All right. Technology clusters, Silicon Valley, Cambridge, Oxford, various other places. Often people ask, well, you know, we've got a lot of technology in such and such a place. Why don't we have lots of entrepreneurial startups? Well, the simple answer to that is you don't have a lot of the other elements as well. Just having a lot of clever people in one room is not enough. Now, we have a lot of clever people in one room, but you already know that more needs to be added to the mix before any sort of venturing is likely to be successful. Now, other elements that are important on the opposite extreme, after you've started a company and run it for a while, it's usually a good thing to sell it off and make great big bundles of money. That's a motivating factor for a lot of people. If you can't capitalize on all your effort, if you can't sell it or get out of it in some way, you're not likely to get into it in the first place. And that holds as true for investors as it does for entrepreneurs. If they see a great, apparently great-looking idea, but they can't figure out how they're ever going to get their money out of it again, no matter how marvelous that idea is, they're not going to invest. So you'll learn a bit more about that in a later lecture. But the environment within which you're entering with your idea also must have a pretty good understanding of the route out. Now, these things on the side, successful role models and networks, they're pretty obvious. It's usually the case that successful entrepreneurs have had successful role models, people either directly in touch with them or that are inspiring them in some way, representing the virtue of pursuing an entrepreneurial life despite all of the difficulties, or perhaps actually advising during those difficulties. So this is another purpose of such events as this, is to show those of you that aren't otherwise regularly here, that this is a community of people, some of whom have gone through the process you're now beginning or engaging in. And you know, events such as the things that Barbara mentioned, the MBAs volunteering their time, or the Douglas Haig lecture where lots of senior people come back, all create opportunities for both meeting potential role models, seeing or learning about their accomplishments, and then also general networking, such as you're doing now. Now, I'll go into more detail about why networking is so important. It's not just incidentally important. So I'll skip that for now and come back to it later. And then these other things on the side, cultural, attitude, and financing, those are both internal and external factors in any sort of new venture. You need the right attitude in the team as well as in the general operating environment where there is a tolerance of risk, there's a tolerance of uncertainty, there's an eagerness to help or provide resources that are otherwise inaccessible. That's what we mean by cultural attitude. And of course, you can think of cultures that are very receptive or promoting of entrepreneurship, Silicon Valley, Israel, for the most part, England. And you can also think of others that are not. I don't want to embarrass anybody, but I mean, there is a ranking of all the countries in the world that has to put someone on the bottom. I mean, it's Uzbekistan, incidentally. And there are never many surprises about who's on the bottom. What's interesting often is who's on the top. The most recent data for the most entrepreneurially active country in the world, I think 2 or 3 years ago. Anyone want to take a guess? Per capita? I'm hearing Israel, I'm hearing the States. Nope. Not India, no. This is a bit of a statistical blip, but the answer is Iceland. Iceland. I think that data was gathered before the volcano, before the financial collapse. But you know, there is a cultural attitude in Iceland that does explain some of the trouble it's now in, a sort of risk tolerance and an interest in really, really pushing beyond the local boundaries in order to widen their opportunities. Now, financing, obviously you need money to start a business. You need things other than money. You need debt, for example, or equity, which is selling shares of ownership in an entity. So an ability to understand the right balance of financial instruments in order to equip a company with the monetary resources it needs to operate is, of course, important. And the most important thing is what we're doing now. Education is what results from all of these things working well together. People learn how to do it right. Also, education is what lubricates the interactions between these things. People understand the importance of each of them and the importance of how they work together. So I'm hopeful that you feel already sympathetic to this notion by virtue of your being signed up for building a business, being here for the second week in a row, and being ready to go through the remaining seven courses, all of which will touch on these elements in one way or another. Now, let me just quickly define some things. Let me go back, in fact, to the Iceland example. Iceland could be said to be culturally entrepreneurial on the grounds that it had very constrained resources and managed to find ways to overcome that obstacle to varying degrees of success. Similarly, any entrepreneur will probably say to you, it's much harder than I ever thought it would be. Or the thing that matters least is finding the money. It's all the other resources I need that were difficult to procure. But with that in place, I was able to do what I needed to do. This definition of entrepreneurship, the pursuit of opportunity beyond the resources currently controlled, I think makes a lot of intuitive sense. It's the one that I'm going to have operating behind my comments this evening. What word is missing? starts with an I. Idea. The definition of entrepreneurship does not include the word idea, at least not as far as I've set it up for you. The pursuit of an idea is not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about the pursuit of opportunity, and I want to spend a little time talking about the difference between ideas and opportunities, because they are not the same. Now, roughly speaking, an idea is something that anyone can have at any time without much analysis or critical thinking behind it. We've all had our best ideas where? In the shower, sitting brainlessly in traffic. Ideas occur to all of us. That doesn't mean they're good, and it doesn't mean that they can ever become realities. Now, the difference between an idea and an opportunity is that an opportunity is somewhat more focused. It's somewhat more defined. So where an idea might be free or freely available, an opportunity would be something that could only come into being given certain conditions, if you have certain resources, if you are at the right period or point in time, or in fact, if you are in the right position to grab it, to seize it. So that's what I mean by the difference between an idea and an opportunity, and I think that's what Professor Stevenson meant when he excluded the word idea from his definition of entrepreneurship and emphasized the word opportunity. Now, let me just try to illustrate that. Here are some things that I think are ideas, like a cure for cancer. It's a great idea. Anyone want to dispute that? It's a great idea. Let's cure cancer. No one's pulled it off yet. It would be great if we had cold fusion. Lots of people have tried. Lots of people have apparently come rather close, but they haven't been able to really make it work. So there's no opportunity there as an entrepreneurial venture. There might be some opportunity perceived that's being pursued, but no one's actually crystallized it yet. Now, to think more positively, here are some opportunities that either came along or that people made out of other materials. The cotton gin. Some of you may have noticed just in passing that I am not English. And the American sort of symbol of invention often held up as an avatar of American ingenuity is Eli Whitney's invention, the cotton gin. And the machine itself wasn't all that subtle. In fact, it was really assembled out of pre-existing parts or ideas for engineering processes and machinery. But he managed to do it at the right time, do it with the right market, do it with the right competitive environment, so that it was a runaway success as a business and also as a social force that set in motion all kinds of other changes. So the difference between the idea of being able to mechanize the process of dealing with cotton and actually turning it into not just a machine but a business, that's the difference between an idea and an opportunity. Budget airlines, everyone's tried. Even people like British Airways have tried to launch a budget airline. Does anyone remember Go Airlines? This is like 10 years ago. Some of you remember that. That was British Airways. It was British Airways trying to compete with EasyJet and Ryanair. But they couldn't make it work. It was a great idea, but they didn't have the right people in place, the right attitude, the right processes inside their larger corporation to manage this radically different business paradigm. And so it failed. It just died on the vine. So is it beginning to become clear by illustration the difference between an idea and an opportunity? On the one hand, you can give a very academic distinction, but I hope that these images or these caselets will give you some better illustration of what I mean. Now, of course, it's not easy. It's not always easy. In fact, it's usually very difficult to tell whether something is an idea or an opportunity. That's what venture capitalists are here for. That's what loan officers are here for. That's what an enormous number of people spend all day long doing, trying to decide whether the idea in a business plan is really an opportunity or not. And so, a lot of things even come into being, have some dimension of reality without being clearly business opportunities or ventures that are going to last in a sustainable way. Now, I have my doubts about Twitter. I'm not supposed to say that here because Biz Stone, one of the founders of Twitter, is a great friend of the school. In fact, I think he's going to be here in like a week or something. So erase these slides. Eat them. Eat them now. No, but the Twitter doesn't make any money so much really by operations as by its brand and the way they've capitalized on the brand. So the brand Twitter was a good opportunity. The operational model behind that brand is sustained by things other than a really believable revenue model. Now, I didn't believe Amazon was a good idea. So we just need to wait. Clean coal is another thing. Now, why might clean coal not really crystallize into an opportunity per se? Probably because something else will supplant it as a better way of producing clean power or achieving the purpose of clean coal. If the purpose of clean coal is green energy, well, it's likely that eventually, or rather more rapidly, alternative sources will come online and become universally adapted, and clean coal won't be able to keep up. So it won't be a long-standing successful idea. I don't know. That's my guess. You heard it here first. You don't have to believe it. I probably won't be around to see the results of that prediction. So my point there is mainly that it's hard to tell. It's very hard to tell. And it takes a lot of proof, or at least argument, to assert that your idea is, in fact, a viable opportunity. That's what I'm here to talk about. Of course, I've just spent 20 minutes starting, and I've only got 20 or so to go. But making sure that this point is clear is often the biggest difference between an unsuccessful, hardworking, worthy, but ultimately frustrated entrepreneur and someone who's much more likely to succeed. Okay, another definition of entrepreneurship is this, the idea that you can see a challenge where others see a problem, or that you can see an opportunity to make something where others see an obstacle to avoid. And this is, again, a sort of intuitively obvious statement, but I want to talk a bit about how this definition and the other definition, both of which, incidentally, avoid the word idea, can be fleshed out in more analytical terms in a way that you can use when trying to prove your idea is actually an opportunity. Incidentally, I have made one or two tiny changes to the slides, so they're not going to be the same as your printouts. I'm sorry about that, but I had an idea in the shower, and I had to act on it. Also, I think the slides are printed vertically, so it goes 1, 2, 3 on the left-hand column, 4, 5, 6 on the right. It's abnormal. I want to make now, instead of the distinction between idea and opportunity, I want to make another distinction, that between entrepreneurial on one side and managerial on the other. And this is, again, something I sort of began with. It's possible to think of these things as two ends of a continuum, not as opposites. Don't want to think of them as opposites. Any organization needs people to run it smoothly. But equally, any organization needs people to think more about the future or more about different ways of doing things that might be better. Every organization exists somewhere along the continuum, rarely on either extreme. I'm sure lots of people would like to think that Oxford University is a beautifully managed, highly managerial environment. That's not true. There's lots of entrepreneurial activity here. You're representing a large amount of it. But on, you know, from an outside view, it looks like something that's been well managed for 800 years plus and will continue to just float along like that. Similarly, you might think that IBM or McKinsey are managerial organizations. They haven't lasted this long or done this well without the pursuit of new opportunity beyond their currently controlled resources. Or without a general commitment to opportunity, a sense that opportunity is worth pursuing, even if you haven't perceived it yet, that you must get your house in order so that when you perceive an opportunity, you're ready to pursue it. When you perceive something that others might see as an obstacle, you're ready to perceive it as a challenge worth overcoming. That might mean having resources ready for when the time comes, or having resources flexible enough to use when that idea occurs to you and you need to test it and prove to yourself first and others later that it's actually an opportunity worth pursuing. So, again, I'm not trying to denigrate the notion of managerialism, but to say that entrepreneurialism is somewhat different and yet related, but it is what will push organizations and individuals forward. Here's another way to think about it. If you have a high opportunity focus, in other words, if you're always looking out for the next thing, and you have a very high level of managerial ability, in other words, you can keep things in control, reduce complexity. If both of those things are working for you, you're likely to be more successful and perhaps able to lead teams of other people in any sort of entrepreneurial venture. So that, in many ways, is the sweet spot. A lot of people, though, think about entrepreneurship as existing elsewhere. For example, a lot of people think, oh, well, I've got this great invention. I'm going to be rich someday. That's not true. I can tell you that categorically, that without any ability to capitalize on your invention or to organize all the other things in the enabling environment so that they favor you and favor the adoption of your invention, you're not likely to, well, you're not going to make anything more of it. In universities, there are a lot of people like this, inventors. We're surrounded by them. Many of us are inventors. It doesn't mean we cannot move up into a different quadrant by taking on new skills or by accessing networks of people who can help us capitalize on our invention. So I hope you can begin to see, even in just this instance, the importance of having a network of people or other resources that you can tap into if you've got this but nothing else. I'm going to move quickly on to illustrate the point again from a different angle. A lot of people ask me, where do opportunities come from? You know, if they don't come from the shower, or you know, how do you know the difference between an idea and an opportunity? Or how do you perceive something and know straight away that it's a good opportunity? I can answer that. I can answer that in some detail. Here are the four answers. Opportunities tend to come from certain conditions. So large-scale trends. If there's a trend towards something, there's likely to be an opportunity in there because there is a general drift of attention in that direction. That means there'll be a general drift of resources, a general drift of demand, a general drift of supply. And putting all those things together, you're going to result in more likely sustainable opportunities. Similarly, a lot of people experience or observe problems in the world and, because of their own knowledge, come up with a way of fixing that problem. That's often how university intellectual property gets commercialized. People know a hell of a lot about something, and they know where the problems are, and they know how to fix them before others do, and getting ahead of that curve constitutes an opportunity. Similarly, or maybe a stage earlier, the process of research generates that kind of awareness of clear, unmet need of one sort or another. And finally, often research or observation or experience indicate ways of changing something that works well enough but could work better. So being able to adapt something or move it to a different environment is often the source of an opportunity. Okay, so these examples, I'm not quite sure what I meant by the teacup at the top. I think I meant something like coffee was a trend and people who were able to capitalize on the drift in England away from tea towards coffee were perceiving some opportunity there. Similarly, Starbucks, just to stick with the coffee thing, had its genesis in the founder's observation of good, easy-to-make coffee in Italy, and he managed to move that model to America and then the South Pole and everywhere else on the planet Earth. So that's what those examples mean. All right, now, I want to try to, because we're all academically inclined, let me try to put this back into a theoretical framework And I also hope it will help you organize the ideas in your mind in such a way that they're easy to remember, easy to carry away. Also, because this is a business school, and those of you that are members of the business school will know that it's impossible for a business school lecturer to get half an hour into a lecture without using a 2x2 matrix. In fact, it's part of our job contract. We have to use 2x2 matrix at all times. So here I am satisfying that requirement. Here's a way I'd like us to think about what I'm going to talk about. We're looking at market factors and industry factors, and I'll explain this in more detail in a minute. We're looking at a high level of detail and at a low level of detail, and also at a complexity of resources that underpin all four of those different dimensions. First, let me talk about yet another distinction, that between market and an industry. The difference between market and industry is very simply defined. Market is the demand side of an environment. Who wants something? And why? Industry is the supply side. Who provides something? And in what conditions? Understanding the difference between market and industry is somehow rather difficult. I don't know why often people use these words rather interchangeably. They'll say, you know, in the market for coffee, Starbucks, Costa, and Nero compete on the basis of X or Y or Z. Well, that's an incorrect use of the word market, because what you're really describing there is the supply side of the industry, the three big players who compete with each other and are reacting to each other's behavior in decision-making. So a proper way to phrase that sentence would be to say, in the coffee industry, Starbucks, Nero, and Costa interact with each other in the following ways. Okay. So the framework that I gave you earlier distinguished between market factors and industry factors. That's just basically a way of saying, I'm going to look at how to think on a high level and a low level of detail at demand side factors and supply side factors. Okay. Now let me do this slightly backwards. There are a lot of myths about entrepreneurship and starting businesses, and this is the worst. I hear this all the time. When I was in the business of investing and reviewing lots of people's business plans, one version of this or another would come at me every 30 seconds. I've got this great idea, and as soon as I turn it into a reality, everyone will buy it. Or I've got this new process that is so efficient that as soon as anyone who knows anything about this machinery, as soon as they see that, they will want this process. That is usually not true. It's sometimes true, but it is usually not true, and it's a terribly dangerous thing to start thinking early on, because you have to line up so many other facts, resources, people, money, all of whom have to believe the same thing without any proof that your statement is true, and that's almost always impossible to do. Someone somewhere along the line is going to cry foul or ask more questions. And if you're not ready to answer them, if all you've got is your belief, then ultimately they will leave you, your supporters. So that's a myth. Try to resist it by gathering more data, more evidence, to prove whatever it is that you believe about your idea. And I'll go into more detail about how you can do that. Now, that was a kind of a demand-side myth, that everyone will want this when I create it. There's a supply-side myth that I often hear, which is basically, no one's ever thought of this before. No one's ever done this before. First of all, that's completely false. There's nothing new under the sun. There's always some way of thinking about something that's equivalent or close, but maybe not exactly right. And it's very rarely true that you can quantify the exact difference in such a way that makes it seem like a compelling proposition. If you can, that's great, and it does happen. but it takes a huge amount of proof and evidence. So that's what I'm going to try to show you how to gather. Another reason why this is a myth is that, you know, if no one's ever thought about it before, maybe that's because it's stupid. Okay? This is indeed very common. I'm sure you've all encountered varieties of this before. All you really have to do to, if you don't believe me, is turn on Dragon's Den or X Factor, any of these things. I mean, you know, most of the time, the whole point of that as television is that they can guarantee 90% of the people that appear are going to be dumb and suggesting some foolish thing. So that's what's going on there, is that usually things have never been done before because they can't be done. Or because if it looks like a duck and it swims like a duck and it quacks like a duck, but it's battery operated, it's not a duck. And if people want a duck, that battery operated thing is not going to be good enough for them. So people always think, well, I've got something that's almost right, but it isn't quite right. Or I've got something that's slightly different from the competition because I can make it different. That doesn't necessarily mean that it's got a future. All right. So I hope I've made my point. Now I need to show you how to prove your point if you truly believe that what you've got is worthy. Okay, now I hope what I'm going to explain will be sort of tangible and take-awayable. Using this framework, there are some questions or there's some kinds of data that you can cluster and organize in making an argument to someone that you want to invest in your venture or your department chair whom you need to convince to take a year off to develop this idea, or your Auntie Mabel who is going to give you the money just because she loves you. You can give her more confidence by proving the validity of your venture by organizing the evidence in a certain way. So going back to the framework, let's just look at the four big quadrants. At the macro level, the high level on the demand or market side, you need to gather some evidence about the large-scale trends in the environment where you're going to be operating. So you know, what is the current demand for coffee? How many people drink coffee? How much coffee is served in a certain geographical area? That's a useful piece of information if you're going to start a coffee-related business. Also, you need to know not how many people are doing it now, but how many people were doing it recently, and also probably more data points. If you can forecast how many people will be doing it with reliability at a significant period in the future, then you've got a trend. You can say it's rising like this, nearly vertical, or it's rising at a level of verticality that's acceptable to me. Or you might discover, and this is much more important, that actually the trend is negative or just flat. And if you find out that the trend at the macro demand level is not attractive to a new entrant, then exit. The value of knowing this kind of information early is that you do not waste your most precious resource, which is time and other people's patience. Finding some sort of fatal flaw in your idea early on is probably more valuable than getting all of the evidence together and going forward. Because for the most part, most ideas are not so good. And if you can learn that early on, you'll save yourself a hell of a lot of time and money, and you can move on to the next idea and test that. Okay? So look at the macro level at whether or not you've got a large-scale trend on your hands. What is the size of demand and the rate of growth of demand that you're dealing with? Then you need to ask, okay, great, there's a lot of coffee being drunk more than ever before, but will they buy my coffee? Who are they? How much will they pay? Why will they pay? And will they keep paying? You need evidence like that. It's not enough to say a lot of people in England drink coffee now and they used to drink tea. You also have to say why they're going to drink your coffee and not someone else's. And how much, you know, cash will they swap for it? I mean, I certainly remember when Starbucks first emerged, or people in England knew that Starbucks and such like were in other countries, and they were saying, can you believe those Americans? They actually pay... you know, the equivalent of £2 for a cup of coffee. Now, I don't know how many of you have gotten out of Starbucks for less than £2 recently in England. And so people will pay that. It was hard to believe, but there was evidence in America and other places that they did it. And that helped people who wanted to start up Starbucks franchises in England. They were entrepreneurs. They got ahead of the curve, and they win. So on the demand side, those are the kinds of questions you need to ask. Look at the big context to establish a trend. Look at the more focused context to establish specific purchasing decisions among your expected clientele. Now, you also need other evidence on the supply side. So I'll go stand over here on the supply side. The phrase structural comparative advantage is slightly annoying and theoretical. But it basically means, what are the dynamics of competition in the industry? Who are the other people doing this? What are the other trends operating? What other kinds of products other than coffee might people buy with that same money? Or what are being supplied in that same space? This is in some ways the most diffuse and difficult to prove because it's usually open to a lot of interpretation. And the MBA students in here will know that you spend a lot of time and a lot of different analytical modes learning how to assess the competitive dynamics in any given environment. But the fact that it's not as certain doesn't mean it's less credible. You do need to understand, to some extent, the nature of competition in the industry that you might be entering. And one good way to do that is to focus your ideas a little bit more precisely by asking a pretty specific question. Is there some other way for my customer to get whatever it is that she needs? Because if there is, she's not likely to come to me. So if I can somehow represent what I've got as being different from what everyone else has in a way that will attract people, not just arbitrarily different, then I'm onto something. So is there another way for the customer to get what she needs than what I'm proposing, or than what other people in the industry are doing? All right. I hope that's getting clear. Here's a checklist. This is the slide that's not in your handout. Apologies, but we'll post it on the website so you can download it later if you don't want to write all this down now. Here's just a checklist of questions to ask or data to gather. It's just restating it in a slightly different way. For the four quadrants of the previous slide. So you need overall data about trends. You need data about the specific demand factors. Why will people purchase? And then on the supply side, you need to look at the dynamics of competition and how they're evolving over time. And then also at the more focused level, how do you achieve protectable advantages over the competition in such a way that you meet demand better than anyone else. Okay. So again, I'm sorry these slides aren't there in front of you, but there's some pretty specific questions to ask in trying to prove your point. Now, there was a bit in the middle, a sort of zone in the middle of my quadrants, which I haven't discussed yet. And in some ways, this is the most important. Also, in some ways, it's the hardest to deal with. Hardest to prove to someone else when you're trying to evaluate an idea, but also hardest to actually organize when you're trying to run a business or run an organization. The resources. If entrepreneurship is the pursuit of opportunity without regard to the resources currently controlled, in other words, if you don't have any control over your resources, it's very difficult to prove how you're going to deal with them. Wow. But there are three kind of categories in which if you can establish some degree of influence or access, then you're gathering evidence that will be convincing to either potential employees or teammates or investors. Basically, what is the inside the venture or the organization or the people involved in it? What is the attitude to risk? What is their ability to achieve on the necessary factors for success? And what networks can they access in order to do that? And let me expand on all three of those points. Attitude to risk. That basically means, how hard will this person or these people fight for it? If it's a great idea, but it's going to be really, really difficult, and not so fussed, it's not going to work. If it's a great idea, and it's going to be really, really easy to achieve, but the people involved aren't excited by it, it's not going to happen either. This is the sort of stuff that canny investors and venture capitalists and angel investors and even people who provide services for entrepreneurs like lawyers and accountants, this is the sort of stuff they're often looking for. The attitude to risk, the entrepreneurial character in the people involved. And since that is often an investment decision-making factor, it's incumbent upon the person behind the venture to be able to satisfy anyone observing that factor or placing importance on that consideration. So, for example, let's go back to the academic trying to get a year teaching relief so he or his team can pursue the commercialization potential for some research they've been working on. If you've been told that that's probably a good thing to do, you need to concentrate on your new process in order to prove its viability. But really, you'd rather be back in the lab. Eventually, you're going to run out of steam. Or you're going to need to get someone else in to help you at the point beyond which you are motivated or beyond which you're willing to take the risks that time away from research might represent for your career. So this notion of attitude to risk is not just confined to financial risk or organizational risk. It might be about the opportunity cost of not doing something else in your life. Since many of us do have rather complicated and contrapuntal careers, what are we giving up to pursue an opportunity, whatever that might be, that represents risk. And if you don't have the right attitude towards that, someone's going to find that out eventually, and it might either constitute a problem for you or necessitate help. Okay. Now, if it necessitates help, then probably if you've got networks you can tap into, you can find that help. But if you don't have networks, if you are disconnected or you're of a certain personality type that doesn't play well in the sandbox with others, again, someone's going to smell that eventually and realize that your limit factors are not compensated for in some way. Networks are about accessing resources you don't have control over. They're just gates through to other areas you need not inhabit all the time. But they do help lubricate the ability to operate where you're not otherwise comfortable. So if you can prove that whether innately or by virtue of access to other resources, you have the ability to do whatever it takes, then you're proving that you've got control over these resources, at least for the purposes of proving the validity of your idea as an opportunity. If you cannot prove that you've got the ability to execute on those critical success factors, even if all the other ducks are in a row, it's probably not going to work. And that sort of fatal flaw might be enough to perceive early on to allow you to get out of the amount of time and effort wasted in something that's not likely to bear fruit. Okay. Now, I hope you can see that looking in this structured way at an idea, gathering evidence along the lines I'm suggesting, and even looking at some of these human factors, like your own ability to execute on whatever critical success factors are there, is a good thing to do early. It's a good thing to evaluate your idea before deciding, this is an opportunity I've got to drop everything to pursue, or this is an opportunity I've got to get other people committed to. Because if it turns out that that idea was never going to work right in the first place because something critical was missing from this scheme, then you've wasted your time and others, and also you've lost an opportunity to pursue something else that might have been more successful. All right. Just a few brief words more on the softer side of things, on this attitude to risk, ability to execute, and ability to access networks. And then I will stop and take any questions you might have if there's time. We have derived, people who study entrepreneurship, have derived a lot of the understanding behind what I've already shown you from observing what goes on. It's all based on looking at what has worked and not worked in real life. It's not theory that's subsequently being proved empirically. And the same is true about leadership. There's no particular science of leadership, and no one really knows how to tell people how to be a better leader. We know a lot about what to avoid, how not to attempt leading. And similarly, we know a lot about how not to try to be an entrepreneur. But by implication, you can make certain assumptions about what is more likely to work. What is more likely, if you can demonstrate that you've got this, to satisfy someone else that you've got the right attitude to risk or the right ability to execute or achieve the right ability to extract those things from your networks if you don't have it in yourself. So, for example, an entrepreneurial leader is someone who, by whatever means necessary, can prove total commitment to the pursuit of his or her opportunity. And that's not an easy proof, but some people can manage to do it, either by charisma or by data or by testimonials from other people who've seen the individual in action, or by virtue of past achievement. If you've got something to draw on and it satisfies someone else that you're totally committed or determined and will persevere, then that's an enormously important thing. There's no such thing as a good venture that doesn't grow. Basically, there's another word for that. That's not an entrepreneurial venture. That's just a lemonade stand on a Sunday afternoon in August. That's something that's kind of fun to do for a while, but it's not about the entity. It's about a distraction for the people pursuing it. Growth is important for the simple reason that investors who take a risk in a business, and that means financial risk as well as time and effort, need to see some return or the possibility of return in order to get involved in the first place. No one's going to put money or time into a business if they're not going to get that money and time back with interest. And the only way you can get that back is by achieving growth beyond your point of entry. So if your business doesn't look like it's going to go anywhere, it shouldn't start in the first place. This is true for nonprofits, because what they're doing is more of whatever it is that they want to be doing. It's not necessarily financial gain, but it's some other kind of gain that needs to motivate the people involved by virtue of expanding rather than just satisfying a tiny point of entry. And without going into withering detail about all of these items, I think you can see that these are a mixture of soft and hard skills that, when provable, create confidence in the ability of a leader to operate in an entrepreneurial environment, which is different in some important ways from other environments, other leadership responsibilities. For example, if you're leading a team of, air traffic controllers, you don't necessarily need a desire to grow. You just need a desire to get the planes down on time and safe. So leading a team of air traffic controllers is a different leadership activity than an entrepreneurial leader would engage in. And therefore, you don't if you're involved in trying to prove the validity of an entrepreneurial idea, you need to prove that your leadership is appropriate to that idea and not mismatched in some way. Now, as I was saying earlier, we know a lot about how not to be an entrepreneur, how not to be a leader. This is pretty obvious to people who are well-adjusted and socialized, but you'd be surprised how few of those actually emerge in the entrepreneurial community. There is the set of myths about the personality traits that tend to favor entrepreneurial success. It's not true that the hugely self-assertive and entirely unself-aware individual is the typical entrepreneur. In fact, if you look at a lot of the most successful and prominent entrepreneurs, Richard Branson, for example, you see very much the opposite of any of these traits. I don't know if any of you knows Richard Branson or has ever seen a video of him when he's off duty, but he's remarkably introverted. He's quite shy. He's actually camera shy when he's not performing and not, you know, doing his job in maintaining the kind of razzmatazz of the Virgin brand. If you get him as the man and not the brand, he's very, very quiet and very self-effacing and very nervous around other people. It's interesting. The same is true of Bill Gates. Same is true of a lot of people. Even Steve Jobs, for example, whom everyone thinks of as being a bit like the gentleman pictured up at the top, he's not. He's got when he's not always at his best, but when he's at his best, he is very much a team player and a self-effacer. How do you prove that you have the right attitude towards risk? Well, you don't prove it by saying, I love bungee jumping, so I can start a business. You don't do it by saying, I am a Formula One racer, I can take anything, I can handle whatever disaster circumstance throws at me. That sort of foolishness is not going to impress anyone. The kinds of evidence you need that you have the right attitude towards risk are more about this, about commitment, about growth, about being centered in yourself, having a strong set of internal resources that allow you to access external ones. All right. Another way to prove the softer side of things, your ability to achieve whatever is necessary, or your attitude to risk, or your access to networks, is to ask questions like this. You know, can you tolerate uncertainty? Are you happy in an ambiguous environment? In other words, if you like all your ducks in a row, or everything to happen on time, or every T to be crossed and I to be dotted, you're going to be uncomfortable in any sort of startup environment. And if you're uncomfortable, you either have to deal with it, or have other people shield you from it, or simply avoid it yourself. And if you know this about yourself, then don't get in that kind of situation without either hedging against it or knowing that it's going to be difficult for you. I'm not saying that conscientious people cannot be entrepreneurs. I'm just saying that it's always uncertain, it's difficult to maintain order, and if that matters to you, then you have to find some way to compensate for it. And if you're not sufficiently self-aware in advance, that sort of thing is going to weaken your focus. So being able to prove that you can deal with that in advance is often a good way to inspire confidence, to be able to know for yourself and prove to others that your idea can, in fact, be deemed an opportunity. Just to pick another example, on the predisposing factors, do you have certain things that you can draw strength from? Again, I talked about it, role models earlier, experience, perhaps some knowledge of the very basic language of organizations, budgets and finances and accounting. Even if you're not handling all that yourself, can you talk to the person who is and understand what he or she is saying to you? Similarly, industry experience allows you to interpret those competitive dynamics that are on the supply side, to understand what it means when some other company is doing something similar to you, either entering or exiting the market or changing the playing field in some way. Finally, coming back to one of those other definitions of entrepreneurship, do you see a pattern because of your skills or your knowledge or your expertise which others are not perceiving? If you can prove that first to yourself and then to others, you're far more likely to survive and prosper. So in conclusion, here is the framework again. I must attribute it in this form to its originator, John Mullins, who's a professor at the London Business School. If you want to know more about this in detail, his second book, not his most recent book, but his second book, The New Business Road Test, expands on it in detail. It's widely available in online bookshops and libraries near you, and I do recommend it. It's got a very specific practitioner-oriented tone. It's not academic. It's not patronizing. It's designed for intelligent people, and it's all about proving to yourself and to others that your idea is good enough to work with and probably good enough to turn into a reality. That's what I mean by evaluating a venture idea. I hope it's made sense, and thank you for your time and attention.